This is Bradcast producer Desi Doyen. We're off this week, so please enjoy this encore presentation from May 23rd, 2022.
Very quickly, you didn't want to get involved in the Ukraine conflict militarily for obvious reasons. Are you willing to get involved militarily to defend Taiwan if it comes to that?
Yes.
You are?
That's the commitment we made.
Wait. What? We did? I don't remember that.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, Round Mountains KKRN and Eureka's KGOE. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW. Lancaster, Pennsylvania's WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, Columbus, Ohio's WGRN, in Palinville, New York on WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, and Detour Talk, Blanketing Planet Earth, great affiliate, progressive affiliate stations all. Blanketing Planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Welcome to the Bradcast, the hour in which you will not hear paid Russian propaganda, or, for that matter, propaganda from anywhere.
Sounds good to me.
Welcome to it. Thank you. Glad you could join us. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
Well, it appears to be, just another day today. In our everything, everywhere, all at once multiverse era, from Biden in Asia to Russia's assault and war crimes in Ukraine to a new not far right prime minister elected in Australia who hopes to end the climate wars there finally. Is that the right way to characterize that, Desi Doyen? You can't.
I'm sorry. I was talking with the engineer. What was that?
Never mind. It's all right. You go ahead about your. I was talking about Australia.
Yes.
Ending the climate wars, maybe with this not far right wing prime minister.
Yes.
Is that a correct way to characterize that?
That is a correct way to characterize it. The new Australian prime minister is from the Labor Party. Voters apparently got really tired of all of the climate disasters that have been pummeling Australia over the last several years. And the conservative prime minister that they had, who was actually doubling down on coal and natural gas and fossil fuels. So this is a good thing.
And all the paid propaganda that made its way into both Australia and the U.S. for reason. Courtesy of one Rupert Murdoch.
Exactly.
From that to the continuing and, yes, surging again COVID surge, never mind monkeypox for the moment, as Pfizer on Monday announced a plan to vaccinate children under 5 for the first time, to new rulings from our corrupt, stolen, and packed GOP Supreme Court, including a ruling that will make it harder for those sentenced to death, to the death penalty, even after their state-appointed attorneys have failed them, it'll make it harder for them to get a new hearing on new evidence in federal court to prevent them from being killed by the government, even if the evidence proves they are not guilty of a crime. No ruling today, I should say, from the high court, however, on the case that is likely to overturn Roe v. Wade, ending 50 years of constitutional freedoms for reproductive rights. That will be happening within the next few weeks. Bank on it. To primary elections this week in Alabama, Arkansas, and Georgia. Yes, Georgia. Not to mention a critical Republican primary runoff election for attorney general in Texas, a critical Democratic primary runoff for the U.S. House in Texas, and of course, a heads up that in 2 weeks it'll be primary election super duper Tuesday, with elections on the same day on June 7 here in California, also Iowa, Mississippi, Montana, New Jersey, New Mexico, and San Diego, following a break in the primary schedule over the Memorial Day week next week. And then the U.S. House January 6 Select Committee's public hearings will be held. The committee on Monday finally announced their official dates for that, with a primetime hearing kicking it all off 8 p.m. Eastern time on June 9, followed by a four daytime hearings over the following 2 weeks and a closing primetime hearing on June 23rd. Mark your calendars. Any event, yes, everything, everywhere, all at once. That is just a sampling. And so with everything, everywhere, all at once, today we will hit a few of those items in the news quickly before we get to my guest today with some interesting and actually troubling concerns about elections out here in California and something that the Democratic-dominated state legislature out here seems to be hell-bent on doing, no matter how many voting system and cybersecurity experts are begging them to not do it. And no matter how many other states across the country tend to follow California's example when it comes to new election laws. I'll get to that in a moment. First up, some very quick news of note from overseas worth putting onto your radar today, with possible repercussions as well in the days ahead. Just to add to the growing mess, everywhere, all at once. President Joe Biden said on Monday the U.S. would intervene militarily if China were to invade Taiwan, declaring the commitment to protect the island is, quote, even stronger after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It was one of the most forceful presidential statements in support of Taiwan's self-governing in decades. At a news conference in Tokyo, Biden said yes when asked if he was willing to get involved militarily to defend Taiwan if China should invade. That's the commitment we made, he said. Well, that's a first, at least to my knowledge. The U.S. traditionally has avoided making such an explicit security guarantee to Taiwan, with which it no longer has a mutual defense treaty, instead maintaining a policy of what's been described as, quote, strategic ambiguity. Yes, that's actually what the U.S. has been U.S. policy has been officially referred to as, at least until now. Didn't seem so ambiguous today. Anyway, about how far they would go to protect Taiwan, the 1979 Taiwan Relations Act, which has governed U.S. relations with the island, does not require the U.S. to step in militarily if China invades, but makes it American policy to ensure Taiwan has the resources to defend itself and to prevent any unilateral change of status by Beijing. The remarks came as President Biden was announcing a new trade agreement in Tokyo on Monday with leaders of Japan, India, and 10 other countries. The new Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, billed by the administration as a regional economic alliance with friendly Asian nations to counter the influence of China in the region. During the press conference, President Biden cited Russia's unjustified, appalling invasion of Ukraine, saying consequences must be deep and significant to deter other countries who might be considering similar aggression.
We support the One China policy. We support all that we've done in the past. But that does not mean, that China has the ability, the jurisdiction to go in and use force to take over Taiwan. So we stand firmly with Japan and with other nations that not to let that happen. And my expectation is it will not happen. It will not be attempted. My expectation is a lot of it depends upon just how strongly the world makes clear that that kind of action is going to result in long-term disapprobation by the rest of the community.
Very quickly, you didn't want to get involved in the Ukraine conflict militarily for obvious reasons. Are you willing to get involved militarily to defend Taiwan if it comes to that?
Yes.
You are.
That's a commitment we made. That's a commitment we made. We are not, look, here's the situation. We agree with a one China policy. We signed on to it and all the attendant agreements made from there. But the idea that it can be taken by force, just taken by force, is just not appropriate. It will dislocate the entire region and be another action similar to what happened in Ukraine. And so it's a burden that is even stronger.
Joe Biden, on Monday, a White House official said that his comments did not reflect a policy shift for the U.S., so make of that what you will for now. However, the president's words drew a sharp response from mainland China, which has claimed Taiwan to be a rogue province of China. A Chinese military, a foreign ministry spokesperson expressed, quote, strong dissatisfaction and resolute opposition to Biden's comments. He added, quote, China will take firm action to safeguard its sovereignty and security interests, and we will do what we say. So make of that what you will for now. China has stepped up its military provocations against Democratic Taiwan in recent years, aimed at intimidating it into accepting Beijing's demands unify with the communist mainland, as AP reports. Under the One China policy, the U.S. recognizes Beijing as the government of China and doesn't have diplomatic relations with China, with Taiwan directly. However, the U.S. maintains unofficial contacts, including a de facto embassy in Taipei, the capital, and supplies military equipment for the island's defense. Biden added that deterring China from attacking Taiwan was one reason why it's important that Russian President Vladimir Putin, quote, pay a dear price for his barbarism in Ukraine, lest China and other nations get the idea that such action is acceptable. It is not acceptable. I agree with him. It is appalling. Biden's latest comments on Taiwan came just. It is appalling no matter what you hear from anyone who might want to defend what Russia is doing right now. Biden's latest comments on Taiwan came just before he formally launched that long anticipated Indo-Pacific trade pact that excludes Taiwan. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan confirmed on Sunday that Taiwan is not among the governments signed up for the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which is meant to allow the U.S. to work more closely with key Asian economies on issues like supply chains, digital trade, clear energy, and anti-corruption. Inclusion of Taiwan would have irked China, of course, though it's hard to imagine that Biden's comments about them did not do so already. Jake Sullivan said the U.S. wants to deepen its economic partnership with Taiwan on a one-to-one basis instead. But speaking of Ukraine and the lessons being learned in that conflict, a 21-year-old Russian soldier who pleaded guilty to killing a civilian in Ukraine was sentenced on Monday by a Ukrainian court to life in prison. In the first of what could be a multitude of war crimes trials inside of Ukraine, Russian Sergeant Vadim Shishimarin was sentenced for the killing of a 62-year-old man who was shot in the head in a village in the northeastern Sumy region in the early days of the war. Shishimarin, a captured member of a tank unit, apologized to the man's widow in court. His Ukraine-appointed defense attorney argued his client had been unprepared for the, quote, violent military confrontation and mass casualties that Russian troops encountered when they invaded. He has said he would appeal the sentencing on Monday. Shishimarin told the court that he, at first, disobeyed his immediate commanding officer's order to shoot the unarmed civilian, but had no choice but to follow the order when it was repeated forcefully by another officer. Arif Abraham, a British-based human rights lawyer, said the trial was conducted, quote, with what appears to be full and fair due process, including access to an attorney, and noted that following an order is not a defense under war crimes law. Ukrainian prosecutors are investigating thousands of potential war crimes, and to be frank, I had a difficult time not feeling terrible for this kid who said, and he was a kid, he's 21 years old, he said he had no idea he would be going to war when he was shipped out. He had joined the military to help make life better for his parents. It's also sad and pathetic, to be frank. Meanwhile, in a stunning public expression of opposition to the war from the ranks of the Russian elite, been waiting for this for a while, a veteran Kremlin diplomat at the UN has resigned and sent a scathing letter to foreign colleagues in which he said of the invasion, quote, "Never have I been so ashamed of my country as on February 24 of this year." Boris Bondarev, a veteran Russian diplomat at the UN office in Geneva, resigned and sent a letter railing against the, quote, "aggressive war unleashed by Russian President Vladimir Putin," and told AP, quote, "it is intolerable what my government is doing now." I want to read his brief letter, his brief statement in full, because, frankly, it's remarkable to hear from a top Russian diplomat at the UN. After Russian President Vladimir Putin has made it clear that dissent will not be tolerated in that country, in their military, certainly in their State Department, their foreign ministry, certainly not on their media, their paid state propaganda media, which spreads its tentacles not just in the in Russia but all over the world. So. Yeah, Putin made it clear that there would be no such dissent. He said back in March, for example, that the Russian people can distinguish between, quote, "true patriots from scum and traitors." Well, I guess Bondarev is now one of those scums and traitors, despite his years in the Foreign Service on behalf of Russia. He's the counselor at the permanent mission of the Russian Federation to the UN. He said he had left the civil service on Monday. He posted this statement on both his LinkedIn and Facebook pages. Quote from Boris Bondarev, "Long overdue, but today I resign from civil service. Enough is enough," he wrote. "For 20 years of my diplomatic career, I have seen different turns of our foreign policy, but never have I been so ashamed of my own country as on February 24 of this year." That was the day that Russia invaded Ukraine. The aggressive war unleashed by Putin against Ukraine and, in fact, against the entire Western world is not only a crime against the Ukrainian people, but also perhaps the most serious crime against the people of Russia. With a bold letter Z crossing out all hopes and prospects for a prosperous, free society in our country. Bondarev writes, "Those who conceive this war want only one thing, to remain in power forever, live in pompous, tasteless palaces, sail on yachts comparable in tonnage and cost to the entire Russian Navy, enjoying unlimited power and complete impunity. To achieve that, they're willing to sacrifice as many lives as it takes. Thousands of Russians and Ukrainians have already died just for this." Bondarev said, "I regret to admit that over all these 20 years, the level of lies and unprofessionalism in the work of the foreign ministry has been increasing all the time. However, in most recent years, this has become simply catastrophic. Instead of unbiased information, impartial analysis, and sober forecasting, there are propaganda clichés in the spirit of Soviet newspapers of the 1930s, a system has been built that deceives itself," he wrote on Monday. The decades-long counselor for Russia at the UN. Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov is a good illustration of the degradation of the system. In 18 years, he went from a professional and educated intellectual, whom many of my colleagues held in high esteem, to a person who constantly broadcasts conflicting statements and threatens the world, that is, Russia, too, with nuclear weapons. He is right on all of this, as we've been trying to point out on this program, particularly to some on the left who claim to be anti-war and correctly hold the U.S. accountable for its own inexcusable invasions of other sovereign nations, only for some reason to give Russia a pass somehow based on, yes, propaganda disseminated by Russia. And too many have fallen for that propaganda. Back to Bondarev's statement here. He says that today the Ministry of Foreign Affairs is not about diplomacy in Russia. It's all about warmongering, lies, and hatred. It serves the interest of the few, the very few people, thus contributing to further isolation and degradation of my country. Russia no longer has allies, and there is no one to blame but its reckless and ill-conceived policy. I studied to be a diplomat, he writes, and have been a diplomat for 20 years. The ministry has become my home and family, but I simply cannot any longer share in this bloody, witless, and absolutely needless ignominy. Bondarev, a decades-long counselor at the permanent mission of the Russian Federation to the United Nations in Geneva, who added at the very end, job offers are welcome.
Oh, wow.
I guess they are.
Yeah, and he might also want to beef up his security?
Yeah, I was going to say, along with the safe asylum somewhere at this point, somewhere that is not in Russia. So anyway, I am taking this as good news to see that there are those in the top ranks in Russia who are finally willing to risk their jobs and, frankly, their lives to speak out against these unspeakable atrocities right now being carried out by Putin's Russia. I can only hope that some on the American left, and again, it's not a lot, but there are some, including, I know, some who listen to this program because I hear from them from time to time. I can only hope that some of those folks will show even a percentage point of the courage that Russia's Boris Bondarev is showing here to review their own assumptions about all of this, to review the amount of propaganda that they have taken on and bought into, and admit that, you know, while it might have been appropriate, was appropriate to hold the U.S. and EU and NATO to account for exacerbating tensions in the region in recent decades, nothing justifies the appalling war and war crimes that are now being carried out in Russia's name. Nothing. Again, if you were anti-war and you held the U.S. accountable when they invaded a sovereign Iraq, as I did, well, you simply cannot consider yourself anti-war if you are not willing to condemn Russia's equally brutal invasion of its sovereign neighbor Ukraine in the strongest terms possible. If time allows, after speaking with my guest here momentarily on something entirely different, I'll be happy to take your calls on this at 818-985-5735 to tell me why I am wrong, if you like, or to discuss anything else that may be on your mind at the start of another horrifically busy news week, apparently. 818-985-KPFK, if time allows today. Please jot it down. Let's take a quick break here now and a seemingly whiplash-inducing change of topic because, again, as I said, it is everything, everywhere, all at once. As California Democrats, incredibly enough, right now, are on a path to ignore pretty much all legitimate voting system and cybersecurity experts in the world to begin to introduce, I can't even believe I'm saying this, internet voting. Yes, you heard me right. Because we don't have enough nightmares in our current election system, they want to introduce internet voting right here in the Golden State. One of the nation's top longtime opponents of internet voting joins us next to explain California's SB 1480, which has been moving on a very quick path towards passage in the state legislature right now. He'll be here to explain that bill and why it is such a terrible idea for democracy. That's straight ahead. This is the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
Wait. What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. This happens year after year after year, it seems, here in California, in our state legislature. It's like Democrats there just do not get it. It's a legislature dominated by Democrats, and yet they keep doing this. Okay. Did I say welcome back to the Bradcast? Yeah. Brad Friedman, bradblog.com, all of that. Over the past week or so on this program, with primary season now fully upon us, we've covered widespread voting system problems in Pennsylvania during their primaries last week. It prevented an untold number of voters from being able to vote at all for several hours, the first several hours of voting in at least three different counties, largely due to the failure of electronic poll book computers. With no backup paper poll books at the precinct to take care of the problem, leaving voters unable to vote on unverifiable touchscreen computers used in several largely Republican-leaning counties there. Those poll books were just added to those counties after, well, you may recall a couple of years ago here in Los Angeles, we began using electronic poll books. And on primary day 2 years ago, it was a disaster, as those electronic poll books did not work, and as of course there were no paper poll books to back them up. We also, just last week, discussed the stunning story out of Georgia, where GOP election officials in Coffee County appear to have allowed a bunch of Team Trump MAGA folks to make illicit copies of proprietary voting system tabulation software following their pretend claims that the 2020 presidential election was stolen from Donald Trump. What those folks now plan to do with that software, which is really the key to the kingdom, not just in jurisdictions that use touchscreen voting systems, but also wherever they use hand-marked paper ballot systems as well, because those were also tabulated by the same voting system software that was stolen, it seems, from Coffee County, Georgia, where they are having primary elections on Tuesday and where the Secretary of State is not being completely clear about whether this matter was investigated or not, as we discussed on the show last week. On Friday's broadcast, we were joined by two longtime, well-respected, nonpartisan election integrity and transparency advocates who were threatened with arrest if they step foot on the public property of the Wake County, North Carolina elections headquarters, the most populous and arguably most Democratic-leaning county in the state in North Carolina, where they held primaries last week. They were these two election advocates were hoping to serve as observers of the election night tabulation. It's yet another insane story. And like the others, if you haven't heard them, you can download them anytime for free at bradblog.com. And today we move back here to California, where Democrats in the state legislature, as the legislative session draws to a close in the next week or so, are once again trying to push through new election-related legislation that defies the advice of dozens of voting system and cybersecurity experts and organizations and would allow for internet voting here in the Golden State, which is currently, luckily, thankfully, prohibited by law. Senate Bill 1480 is sponsored by Bay Area State Democratic Senator Steve Glazer. It would change that prohibition on internet voting if this law is successfully adopted and then signed by the governor. On Friday, despite opposition from about 40 voting rights and cybersecurity groups, including Brennan Center for Justice, California Voter Foundation, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Verified Voting, Public Citizen, some of our personal favorites like Coalition for Good Governance, Free Speech for People, Scrutineers.org, not to mention about a dozen grassroots indivisible organizations, Progressive Democrats of America, and others, and with the support. So that was the opposition. The support of a handful, less than 10 groups, including Microsoft and the California Council of the Blind. With all of that, SB 1480 passed out of the State Senate Appropriation Committee and now heads to the State Senate floor. This week, I believe, if adopted, it moves to the Assembly for approval there, then to the governor for his signature, unless it is stopped, given that this all could happen within the next week. It needs to be stopped quickly. Here's the description, part of the description of SB 1480 from the Legislative Council's Digest for what they are calling electronic remote accessible vote by mail systems. In other words, internet voting. The digest explains this bill would require a county elections official to permit a voter with a qualifying disability to use a certified remote accessible vote by mail system that enables the voter to return a completed ballot electronically. The bill would permit the Secretary of State to certify this type of remote accessible vote by mail system and to develop procedures for a voter using the system to submit a signature electronically as well. So no more ink wet signature on those return ballots if we move to this internet system. It would be an electronic signature. Good luck comparing that to a real one. The digest goes on to explain existing law imposes various restrictions on voting systems generally, including that no part of the voting system shall be connected to the internet at any time. That's good. Existing law specifically prohibits a remote accessible vote by mail system from having the capability to use a remote server to mark a voter's selection transmitted to the server from the voter's computer via the internet. Nor may it store any voter identifiable selections on any remote server or to tabulate votes. This bill, however, they note, would exempt the aforementioned remote accessible vote-by-mail system from these prohibitions. Now, as I understand it, SB 1480, until such time as the Secretary of State actually certifies one of these internet voting systems, qualified disabled voters would also, through SB 1480, be allowed to vote by fax, which, as I think my guest will explain, is also a very serious concern among voting system and cybersecurity experts. Joining us now to help us unpack this concern that has been on almost nobody's radar, other than Democrats in the state legislature here in California or those trying to stop this latest effort to move to internet voting, is longtime voting system and cybersecurity expert Dr. David Jefferson. Dr. Jefferson worked for years at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories in California, where he remains a visiting, if retired, computer scientist. And as an internationally recognized expert on voting systems and election technology, he's been a pioneer in research at the intersection of computing and the internet and elections for more than 20 years and has been an advisor to five successive secretaries of state here in California on technology-related issues, specifically on voting technology. David Jefferson has spent many years warning about the dangers of internet voting, now including one of the newest ill-considered trends, blockchain voting, as we, I think, last talked with him about on this program. Dr. Jefferson was a longtime member of the board of directors of the California Voter Foundation and of Verified Voting, two nonprofits, nonpartisan organizations devoted to promoting open, secure election technology. Dr. David Jefferson, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Hi, Brad. It's great to be with you again. I hope you can hear me okay.
I can hear you just fine. You sound great, David. Thank you. Before we get into why this bill is such a concern, not just for California, but frankly for the entire country, which tends to follow on California voting trends, this law references an electronic remote accessible vote by mail system, or electronic RAVBM. What is understood to be meant by that phrase, David Jefferson?
Well, so remote accessible VBM, remote accessible vote by mail, is a concept that's already in the California Elections Code, and it's intended to help disabled or remote voters, say overseas voters, mm-hmm. vote. And the idea of non-electronic RAVBM is that the voter downloads a blank ballot, fills it out on their computer, then prints it on paper and mails it back through the mail system to the county. So it's a paper ballot, it's mm-hmm. auditable, it's voter verified. The electronic RAVBM is kind of a a contradiction in terms, because mm-hmm. you're no longer mailing a piece of paper back. You are, after filling out the ballot on your computer screen or your mobile device, you then click a button that says send it back by fax or some other electronic means. Mm-hmm. And it inevitably travels over the internet from the voter back to the jurisdiction that's going to count it. Mm-hmm. So it's not a voter verifiable ballot by the time it gets to the jurisdiction, and it's not meaningfully auditable because it's not voter verified, and it's subject to many cybersecurity hazards along the way that we can talk about.
The bill text says, upon certification, county election officials shall permit a voter with a qualifying disability to use a certified remote accessible vote-by-mail system that enables the voter to return a ballot by electronic means and in a private and independent manner. Now, it says, quote, qualifying disability means a disability that prevents a voter from reading, marking, holding, handling, or manipulating a ballot, including blindness, visual impairment, or an intellectual or developmental disability or impairment in dexterity, such that the voter is unable to return a ballot privately and independently, which, by the way, is a requirement of the Federal Help America Vote Act of 2002, that voters, including disabled voters, be allowed to vote privately and independently. So, David Jefferson, that sounds useful. What's wrong with that?
Well, first, let me acknowledge that everybody recognizes that disabled voters have many barriers to simple and easy voting. And nobody wants to put additional barriers or to get in the way of disabled voters. But the concern here is a balance between the fundamental security of the integrity of the election, mm-hmm. which is a national security issue, mm-hmm. compared to the convenience or inconvenience of voters with certain disabilities. And as much as I would like to be able to find different ways of aiding disabled voters, allowing them to transmit ballots over the internet is just not one of them, because of the terrible danger that it provides to the mm-hmm. to the integrity of the election. Really, California has been a leader in not allowing any form of internet voting, mm-hmm. And other states, some other states have copied that. You know, because they often look to California for leadership on technical issues. Mm-hmm. This would be, in my opinion, a giant step backwards to extend internet voting to the disabled voters or to any voters. And it's just too dangerous. And unfortunately, it would be the votes of the disabled voters themselves that are at risk.
Yeah. And we've seen this introduced really year after year, session after session, by Democrats, I'm sorry to say, in the state legislature up in Sacramento. And I know that you and others have spoken out against these bills. Have we been successful in the past in stopping this madness? But now this is moving very quickly, David. Is this just, you know, is the concern here this is poking the camel's nose into the tent, so to speak? It's, you know, it's only disabled voters. It'll be through some sort of a limited fax system. Is the concern that this one is, you know, one small step for internet voting that could easily expand to fully remote internet voting for all voters? Or is it concern enough just that the door is being opened even to a limited number of so-called qualified disabled voters?
So there are a couple of angles on this. One is that you could argue that the camel's nose is already under the tent with internet voting, because in California, so-called UOCAVA voters, that is uniformed military and overseas mm-hmm. citizens, mm-hmm. are also already allowed to vote by fax. So this is an extension of it can be viewed as an extension of that already. We are extending the same privilege to these categories of disabled voters. So the camel's head, you know, would be under the tent at that point. Mm-hmm. It's pretty clear to many of us that the long-term goal of some of the backers, the moneyed backers of bills like this, and by the way, it's not just California. These bills pop up all over the country.
Yeah.
That their long-term goal is to open the door to internet voting to all voters if they can. They've tried before, and in In some states, they have succeeded for some time, although it fortunately hasn't lasted. Hmm. So, yes, that's definitely a realistic concern.
And until such a system is actually certified by the Secretary of State, according to this bill, it sounds like qualified disabled voters will be able to immediately start voting by fax. Why is that a concern? I mean, in the old days, they used to say, well, that was one of the most, secure from a fax modem to somebody else's fax modem, that was a very secure way to transfer information.
Yes, so that is a concern. You're right. Until the Secretary of State certifies some other electronic RAVBM system, if she ever does or he ever does, until that time, this law requires for all 58 counties to immediately start accepting fax ballots from this disabled voter community. And
immediately, meaning this year for the, midterms?
No. When the bill is on the books. So probably starting in January would be my guess.
Okay.
Not this year.
Okay.
Well, at least I presume it's not this year. Yeah. I was told that by the elections committee.
Yeah.
I hope it doesn't come into force before the general election.
Right.
And by the way, it's being voted on like in the next hour or so. It's not just this week. It's today
The
Senate will vote on it.
Right.
So the concern with fax voting is that for all practical purposes today, faxes are transmitted over the internet. Nobody has an old fashioned fax machine at their home anymore. People who transmit faxes do so from their computer or mobile device. And they don't have fax modems anymore either. Mm-hmm. So they are transmitted over the internet to some company that then forwards the fax, either through conventional means, if the receiver happens to have an old fashioned fax machine, or through the internet to the receiver. But either way, these ballots will travel over the internet, and they are heir to all of the, security problems that all other internet voting systems are heir to.
And yet, David, we've talked about this over the years, of course, but I think it needs repeating, sadly. What's wrong with voting over the internet? We do banking over the internet. We do our shopping over the internet. A lot of people believe it's, completely secure. You pay your taxes over the internet. Why shouldn't we be able to vote over the internet?
So let me come back to that for a second, because I want to make another remark about fax in particular.
Okay.
As far as faxes transmitted over the internet are concerned, people have to understand that this is at the bottom of the security hierarchy for internet computation. It's down there with email. Faxes as a technology is older than the internet, in fact, and security was never a part of that protocol. So that the caller's number can be forged, the caller ID can be forged, the faxes are not transmitted end-to-end encrypted. Mm. These are the same properties that email has, and it's just, and in some cases the faxes are emailed in the last hop to to their destination anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So among the internet voting transmission protocols, it's at the bottom at the security level.
Gotcha.
But it also inherits, as I said, all of the other problems that internet voting systems are heir to. Internet voting is not like it's not like an e-commerce transaction at all. It's not like buying a book from Amazon, even though it superficially looks the same, because fundamentally there are differences, important differences, profound differences between the secrecy requirements, the security requirements, the availability requirements, and the population in the world that is interested, has any interest in attacking you. For example, the Russians do not care whether Amazon sends you a book or not. They're not going to put a lot of their effort into preventing Amazon from sending you a book, but they will put a lot of effort into preventing your vote from being delivered if they don't like the way you voted. So there's really no comparison in the security and privacy and availability requirements for public elections and for e-commerce.
There is, as I said, a bunch of groups in opposition to this SB 1480 here in California. They cite the ongoing conflict in Ukraine, the threat of Russian cyber attacks on our election infrastructure has increased. Election security is a matter of the highest U.S. national security. So we would be taking a very grave risk to our democracy anytime the threat of foreign interference is escalated, as it is now. In truth, David Jefferson, I would say I am as concerned, not just about foreign interference, as you cite and as they cite there, but the threat of domestic interference, given what we have been reporting of late with the GOP election officials actually stealing and making copies of proprietary voting system software, releasing it onto the internet. It sounds like both of these foreign and domestic interference should give us pause before moving forward with something like this in California or anywhere.
So you're absolutely right. Anyone in the world with an internet connection can attack an election conducted over the internet or ballots transmitted over the internet. Yes, our foreign adversaries, we quote a lot, but domestic threats to our elections are just as real and may be becoming realer. Mm. And one of the things that everybody has to be aware of is that, it's hard to, if an election is attacked through the internet, it's hard to even know that the attack has occurred.
Right.
I mean, it's easy to expect that elections that the outcomes of elections may be switched, and we never know that there was any problem with the election. So mm-hmm. the wrong people are in office, the wrong laws have been passed by the people, and we never know it. Or if we do know it, we'll know it too late. Or if we mm-hmm. ever find out about it, it'll be too late to fix anything. There is no recourse. Unless you rerun the whole election, for which there's almost no precedent in the history of the United States. So,
and this, David, is one of the things that's most amazing to me about this. I mean, if we, look around at what we have been not just reporting on the show, but reporting on nationally, everywhere, really, for the past year and something now since the November 2020 election. The idea that we would want to go to a technology that, even if it is secure, even if every vote is counted perfectly, accurately, there would be no way to actually prove to the public that it actually was counted accurately, just seems to be madness. It's like, I don't know if these folks in Sacramento are living in a cave and they haven't heard that there is this whole phony stop the steal movement coming from the right. I would think they would understand that, and they would want to make sure that any election processes are as public as possible, to help prevent people from falsely claiming that an election was stolen, whether it was or wasn't through one of these schemes on the internet. David, you've worked directly with many California secretaries of state over the years as an advisor in various capacities. Has our recently appointed Secretary of State, Dr. Shirley Weber, either taken a position on this bill 1480 yet, to your knowledge, or has she reached out to tap your expertise on any of these issues?
So to my knowledge, she has not taken any kind of public position. Mm-hmm. Of course, she came from the legislature, so she has private relationships with the legislature, and she did send her staff, for example, to the Senate Elections Committee hearing a few weeks ago. So I know she's following the bill, but I don't know that she's taken a public position on it. My understanding is that election technology issues are not her primary background anyway.
Yeah.
She comes from the voting rights background. Mm-hmm. And so I suspect these issues will be put in the staff in the hands of her staff as far as making statements about this bill. But she's made no public statement to my knowledge about it. I hope she does.
I hope she does, too, because it's very troubling. It's moving very fast. If it passes, as you note, David, going on right now in the Senate, if it passes there, it goes to the Assembly. I think the Assembly Elections Committee. Yes. And then if it's passed there within the next week, it goes on to the governor. This is a good time to take action on this, frankly, if you're in California or anywhere else, because rest assured, you know, what happens in California, unlike Vegas, does not stay in California. The good longtime election integrity experts over at scrutineers.org have put together a page with information on SB 1480 and actions that you can take to help stop it and or watch out for similar legislation in your own home state. If you're listening from outside of California, their page is at scrutineers.org/California. scrutineers.org/California. It will tell you about this bill and you know, who to contact at the state legislature, at the secretaries of state's office, and so forth. David, I really appreciate your making noise about this, because this is really sneaking through quickly.
Yes.
Is there any evidence that, like I said, all of these groups were against it? Is there any evidence so far that there are Democrats or even Republicans hearing this opposition in the state legislature?
Well, we get good hearings when we talk to staff members. But for example, I was never able to talk to the Senate Elections Committee chairman, of whom I am a constituent, I might add, but that didn't get me a meeting with him. We'll try the same thing on the Assembly side, both in the Elections Committee and then after that, the Appropriations Committee in the Assembly. It has to get through both of those before it gets to the floor of the Assembly and the governor. So we'll keep trying there.
Thank you, sir, for all you do and for continuing to try. I hope others will join you in that effort. Dr. David Jefferson worked for years and years at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California. He also worked years and years with VerifiedVoting.org, with various secretaries of state here in California, has been a champion of voting technology that is public, overseeable, and I guess that makes him and secure, and I guess that makes him an opponent of internet voting. David Jefferson, always great speaking with you, my friend.
Great to be here. Thanks a lot, Brad.
Thank you, brother. Okay, once again, that's scrutineers.org/California for more information. A quick break, and we'll come back with some of your calls. If you'd like to ring in on this or anything else that we've been talking about this hour, 818-985-5735. I think we'll have a few minutes for a couple of quick calls. 818-985-KPFK. I'm Brad Friedman. This is The Bradcast. You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported thanks to listeners like you who stop by bradblog.com/donate. Welcome back. It's The Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Let's take a few quick calls here, 818-985-5735. I know some folks wanted to ring in what I was talking about at the top of this hour and the outrageous propaganda coming out of Russia still, and at least one UN official standing up to it and quitting and saying this is not the Russia I know. Michael in Duarte. Hey, Michael, welcome to the broadcast, sir. Thank you for holding for quite a while. Uh-oh, do I have Michael? I do not have Michael. Okay, let me try. Well, we always have Mo, I think. Let's find out. We got Mo? Wait a minute. Let me work these phones if I can ever learn how to do it. There we go. Oh, Morris, welcome to the broadcast, sir.
Dr. Freeman, what is the difference between election fraud and voter fraud? I'll take your comments off you.
Great question. And you don't have to take my thoughts off the air. Morris, you might have already gone. Election fraud and voter fraud. They're both fraud. Voter fraud is done by actual voters, where voters actually commit fraud. Voters may, we talked a couple of last week or so about a voter, for example, in Arizona who voted for her mother who had died just before the election. Her ballot showed up at her house. She voted for it anyway. She was a Republican who told investigators that she was concerned that Democrats were stealing elections with massive fraud, and then she committed fraud herself. So that is voter fraud. Then there is election fraud. Voter fraud is a type of election fraud, but election fraud is much broader. Election fraud could be, like we were just talking about with David Jefferson there, When somebody, domestic, foreign, or an insider election official, like the ones we were talking about last week, who copied that voting system software in Georgia, where they manipulate the system in some way, they hack into the system. Voter fraud could also be considered, election fraud could also be considered where there is a grand scheme to prevent people from voting, to suppress the vote, to collect absentee ballots, as Republicans did in 2018, and change them without the voters' knowledge, to the point where they had to call off a U.S. House race and rerun a U.S. House race in North Carolina. So voter fraud is a type of election fraud, but election fraud is much, much broader. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question, Mo? Oh, he did listen off air.
That's so right. We don't have him. He said he was going to listen off air.
I ought to take his word when he tells me.
Yes, indeed.
But yeah, that's you had a thought, Des?
Well, it reminds me of a lot of people that seem to have this misunderstanding, because obviously elections are kind of mysterious to many people. So they don't actually know a whole lot about the actual laws and procedures. So it makes it very easy to mislead folks on what procedures are that that are actually pretty good. Like when it comes to, that 2000 Mules documentary that you have been debunking.
Phony right wing. Yeah,
exactly. That most people, if they don't understand the stringent, strict quality procedures that go through for verifying absentee ballots or ballots that are mailed in or dropped off, that they might think that this might be an excellent vector for trying to steal an election. But it seems like it's a silly way to do it, because you could only do it like one or two ballots at a time.
So voter fraud, sort of that retail voter fraud, one ballot at a time, as opposed to being able to get into a computer system remotely, or an insider who works in the election office being able to change hundreds, thousands of votes all at once, and nobody will ever know. And one of the reasons that people are confused about this, why it's difficult to follow, sure, our systems may be okay to protect against fraud, but what makes them actually work is that people oversee them, citizens oversee them. It is not enough to simply trust in any particular process. It's required that we, the citizenry, oversee what goes on in these elections. And when we are locked out, when we use counting systems that cannot be overseen, like internet voting, well, that's when you run into problems and bad guys can show up and claim voter fraud, even if there is zero evidence to support it. Does that sound familiar? Well, that's my nightmare, and that's the nightmare we are currently all living under here in these United States.
And that's why you always call for hand-marked paper ballots, because after the election, that is verifiable.
Thank you very much, Desi Doyen. We got to get out. That's Desi, our producer. Thanks to our board operator, Gary Baca. To my guest today, Dr. David Jefferson, formerly of Livermore Labs and Verified Voting, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any of the other ones, you can download them anytime for free at bradblog.com. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am TheBradBlog. See you there. Until we see you here, hopefully tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.